From training to performing, join our Big League Conversation. Welcome to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast with your host, Eric Cressy.
Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 91. I'm not supposed to play favorites with our guests because I do think we have a ton of awesome ones, but this might have been one of my favorite episodes to record just because as a baseball fan, I saw some of the struggles this pitcher went through, but also as a coach, really appreciated the time he took to step back from the game, to retire and then unretire and really learn about how to coach, how to change movements, how to interact with athletes, and really applied it to what he was doing with himself to go and become nationally comeback player of the year last year. So really good episode with an awesome guy that we really should celebrate his success because it's a great story for baseball. This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens, the most comprehensive NSF certified for sport daily nutritional supplement I've ever tried. With so many stressors in life, it's difficult to maintain effective nutritional habits and give our bodies the nutrients they need to thrive. As a father of three young kids and a co-founder of multiple businesses in multiple states, on top of still being an avid exerciser, I know that busy schedules can really take their toll on us. Whether it's poor sleep, exercise or life stressors, environmental factors, or simply not eating enough of the right foods, we can wind up deficient nutritionally. This is where Athletic Greens can really help. It's a game-changing nutritional insurance policy. They simplify the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you just one thing with all the best things. And that's why I use it daily and recommend it to our athletes. One scoop of Athletic Greens contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, including a multivitamin, multimineral, probiotic, green superfood blend, and more. They work together to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet, increase energy and focus, aid in digestion, recovery, and supporting of a healthy immune system. This all can happen without taking multiple products. While most nutritional products come to market and stay stagnant, Athletic Greens continues to obsessively improve this one holistic formula based on the latest research, producing 53 improvements over the last decade. They invest in the most absorbable and natural source of each ingredient and go above and beyond in third-party testing to ensure their customers continue to receive the highest quality and best daily nutritional habit on the planet. It's lifestyle-friendly, whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, and contains less than 1 gram of sugar without compromising on taste. They put 75 ingredients through the NSF for Sport certification to come up with a formula that's trusted by some of the world's best athletes, including our own. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving our listeners 10 free travel packets with their subscription. Simply go to athleticgreens.com/Cressy to receive my offer. These travel packs are perfect for supporting your immune system, energy, and gut health when you're traveling for games, training, or simply when you're on the go. They can be a great counterbalance to less than ideal on-the-road food options. So if you want to bridge the gap between deficient and optimal and give yourself the best chance to get nutrient diversity, then head to athleticgreens.com/Cressy and get your 10 free travel packets today. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y. Today's guest was a standout pitcher at the University of North Carolina. Following his sophomore year, he led the Cape Cod Baseball League in innings and strikeouts and helped to pitch North Carolina to the College World Series the following year as a junior. The Boston Red Sox selected him with the 28th overall pick of the 2006 Major League Baseball draft. He worked his way through the minor leagues and was called up to the big leagues for the first time on May 10th, 2009. He made his MLB debut 3 days later, throwing two scoreless innings. In 2010, he became a mainstay in the Boston bullpen as the primary setup man. He appeared in 73 games, posted a 1.93 ERA, a 1.0 whip on the season with 76 strikeouts. In 2011, he set a franchise record with 25 consecutive scoreless appearances. After transitioning to a starting pitching role in 2012, his well-documented struggles with command began. After moving on from the Red Sox in 2013, he had minor league stints with the Cubs, Rangers, Cubs a second time, Cardinals, and Mets. He retired in October of 2017 and accepted a role as a franchise player mentor with the Diamondbacks in February of 2018. 2 years later, he announced his comeback and was signed by the Rockies, and he earned a spot on their opening day roster for 2020. On July 25th of last year, he played in his first MLB game since 2013, pitching 1 1/3 scoreless innings in relief. He was credited with the win, his first since 2012. On August 11th, he was credited with a save, his first since 2011. He ended the year with 27 strikeouts and 6 saves in 24 2/3 innings. He was named the NL Comeback Player of the Year and received the Tony Coniglio Award. Please welcome to the show, Daniel Bard.
Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to do this. It's been a cool story I've followed for a long time, and obviously got to know your family as well. So it's cool to see you having the success that you're having back in the big leagues after a hiatus that made for an incredible story. But maybe before we get to the good stuff, I'm curious about how you developed as an arm in your youth. Because let's be real, you threw 100 miles per hour before it was cool to throw 100. I feel like nowadays everybody does it, but you were doing it, you know, in college and into pro ball. Talk to me about where your arm speed evolved, you know, over your teenage years and into early pro ball. You know, were there certain things that you look back on that really helped you to build and sustain it at that level?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always had a good arm as a kid. My dad was a catcher in pro ball for a little while, and that was kind of his one tool. He had a really strong throwing arm. Like, I think scouts that I've run into, you know, recently have been like, you know, your dad had an 80 arm, which they don't just hand those out. Like,
yeah.
So I don't know if you can say there's a genetic component, but there probably is something there. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, my size, but there's plenty of guys my size that don't throw as hard or didn't throw as hard, but fast twitch muscle, I don't know exactly. You can speak to that probably better than I can, but you know, I think there's a whole thing about if your dad played pro baseball or, you know, at a high level or really did anything athletically, like, you automatically have a built-in elite level coach, you know, someone that not only knows the sport, knows the intricacies of it, but you can watch. I could watch my dad throw when he threw a baseball back to me, and I could emulate the way he threw. And it was, you know, pretty, I think that's the best way to learn as humans. Like, no matter what you're doing, it's just, we're good at copying what other people do. And so, you know, I think that was just, I developed really clean arm mechanics from a young age, and, you know, was blessed enough to be athletic and kind of put the pieces together as I got older.
And I know you had two brothers. Were you guys like multi-sport to the nth degree? Like, there was always a different sport taking place in the backyard, or was there more of like a baseball specialization, given that's kind of the avenue all three of you guys went to?
Yeah, we played everything. You know, the big three, football in the yard. Luke took that to another level and, you know, played all the way through high school. But definitely all played basketball probably like through middle school at least, and maybe a little bit in high school. Yeah, I mean, I stunk at golf, so, but I tried, like, you know, you just kind of try everything. You know, I definitely, I think baseball is always my first love, and probably the same for my brothers as well. Luke might say football, but yeah, we played everything.
Nice. So, you know, over the course of your minor league career, you were a college arm, and you moved, I would say, relatively quickly to the big leagues, you know, compared to a lot of your peers, I'm sure. But there was also, you know, jumping back and forth between starting and relieving. I'm curious, as you look back on that, do we underappreciate how challenging a change that is? I mean, I know, you know, certainly Luke dealt with some of that, you know, when he had his injury late in college into early pro ball, like, it was a quick adjustment to, you know, going from relieving to starting that gave him some problems. Did you see some of the same stuff yourself? Were there dramatically different approaches and physical demands going from one to the other that maybe in hindsight impacted some of the challenges you faced?
Yeah, I mean, I had no problem starting in college. Like, the physical demands of it, I could hold velocity, you know, through 100 pitches in, which, you know, I don't know exactly how I was managed to do that. I was just on the standard, you know, college workout program, whatever that was back in 2005, 2006. And, but it worked for me, you know, and got into pro ball, had some struggles that weren't really physical related, but just kind of lost feel a little bit and lost my delivery. So I got moved to the bullpen pretty early in my pro career, and things kind of took off, you know, in a good way. And I think it was more just the shift of mindset of, like, coming out of the bullpen forced me to be more aggressive and just simplify my approach to the way my body moved, my arsenal, everything like that. So I think that's why relieving worked for me. And then I kind of tried to go back in 2012, and again, I don't think it was the starting, like the physical aspect of it that I couldn't handle. It was, I tried to do too many things different. I tried to like take, instead of just taking what made me a good reliever in the big leagues and just like, boom, let's do that for 100 pitches instead of one inning, I tried to like change all kinds of things, make my arsenal more of a starter arsenal, like five pitches instead of just, you know, two and a half. And, yeah. You know, I just tried to do too much. I don't think it was starting itself, but, I always think, you know, you get on a good program, find somebody who knows what they're doing. You know, the physical part should almost be the easy part. You know, I know people deal with unexpected injuries and things like that, but in many ways, like how good a shape you're in is completely within your control.
That's a great point. And I'm actually intrigued. I'm going to ask you a little bit later about, you know, you said two and a half pitches versus five. You know, you were guided through both two and four seams. You got a curveball back then, I think it's kind of a slider now. You still had the changeup. So you did have a broad repertoire compared to like the classic, just, you know, fastball slider guy that we expect to see in a lot of major league pens, but maybe we'll touch on that a little bit later. So, you know, 2011 to 2012, things obviously went astray. And one of the things I'm curious about, I know the last month of 2011 was particularly challenging for you. Do you think that part of the challenges that you faced, you know, as you went to 2012 were to some degree, you know, dwelling on how 11 ended? It's just, you know, it's such a long off season to beat yourself up about things. Or do you think it was, you know, a collection of other things? And, you know, I know there were talk about physical concerns and all that. What was it that you think, you know, kind of led to some of that, in addition to some of the mental stuff you just described in terms of pitch mix and approach?
Yeah, I've described kind of what I went through end of 11 through 12 and into 13 as like the perfect storm of bad things happening to a pitcher at the same time. Not to put pity on myself, but I just think I wasn't prepared for some of the things that I went through. In 2011, I was having the best year of my career, right up until around September 1st. And I think I've had maybe a sub 2 ERA, really good strikeout and walk numbers, leading the league in holds. Was having a great year. And then we kind of collectively as a team collapsed that last month, and my numbers were terrible that month. Nothing like how I pitched the previous 5 months. And I remember a couple outings right at the end of August, early September, where I felt great, physically, mentally, everything sharp. And the outings went terrible. Like, you know, just every little thing, every close pitch didn't get called your way, you know, bloopers falling in, balls hitting the chalk down the line, you know, and I blew a couple big games where I felt great. And then you have two or three of those, and I guess my confidence was at a place where it was not where it should have been. And you know, I kind of started to try to do more. So I said, well, if I feel good and I'm making pitches and I'm still giving up two runs and blowing games, maybe I need to do more. Maybe I need to be better, be nastier, whatever. And so I think that's where that came in. The rest of that month, I think I was trying to make every pitch as nasty as it possibly could be. I think, as any pitcher knows, there's a threshold for effort, and whether that's physical or mental effort, where you just kind of, at some point, you just got to let it happen. And I wasn't doing that. So I think that kind of snowballed on me, carried into the next year. Had a role change, coaches. We had a whole coaching staff turnover between that year. So the new staff didn't really know me enough to like kind of talk me through it and help me through that situation. But and the performance, you know, continued to decline, and got option, you know, designated later, all that stuff. And, you know, I think all those moves have an effect on guys if you let them, you know. And for me, I didn't handle it well. I didn't handle it on the mental side well at all. And, you know, I couldn't ride that wave of success anymore. So, I think – and then, sorry, to go back to the physical side, I think I was dealing with some symptoms of thoracic outlet that I would later get surgery for. I think the doctor that did my surgery, he he said, you probably have had like a mild case that's kind of just been lingering for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And that was 2014. So if you predate it back, you know, he said, yeah, it very easily could have been affecting you all the way back to the end of 11.
Yeah. There was just such a diagnosis of exclusion where it's all these little things that build and build and build over the course of time. And then it just makes sense in hindsight, right?
Yeah. It's such a weird thing. I look back even now that we know about spin rate and things like that, like my velo was pretty good in 11. It's like pretty much in line with my previous 2 years, but my spin rate dropped like 400 RPMs. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that at the time because nobody looked at it, but I looked at it more recently and I was like, man, that's weird. I wonder if that was, I mean, I wasn't throwing any different pitches, so something was different.
I think the resounding theme from guys that do have thoracoskeletal surgery after the fact is they kind of forgotten what it's like to feel good. You know, we had actually a guy who came in and had his in December, but just comments on like, I didn't remember I could actually open my hand this wide. I've been fighting this for years and years and years. It's kind of important for throwing a baseball at a high level. So it's hindsight is obviously always 2020 with these things, but I don't think people realize how probably underdiagnosed this is in all levels of baseball, particularly at the highest level.
Yeah, it's such a weird thing. Like it's, I think there's some cases that are really clear cut, mm-hmm. and you know, you got the your arm turns blue or swells
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
There, I think those are few and far between. I think there's a lot of cases kind of like mine where it's almost like this ghost has come in and inhibited your arm and you don't really know. It doesn't feel like something's terribly wrong, but you know, it's not right.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're getting better technology to actually start to evaluate this. Dr. Pearl in Dallas, she had a great presentation to a lot of the MLB athletic trainers and strength coaches just about like restricted blood flow to the throwing arm is a very normal thing. Obviously that speaks to the vascular side of things, but all the same patterns that can block those off are the ones that can impact the nerves that go down.
He's the one who did my surgery. Yeah,
it's life-changing. You know what, you actually hinted at something where you mentioned, you know, balls were falling in and, you know, velo might've been good. You were getting squeezed on pitches, things like that. Those things can snowball. And I can't help but think back like, all right, that was 2011 into 2012. Like we both know it. Analytics weren't then what they are now, right? So you can very easily go and look at, you know, was that ball framed incorrectly by your catcher? You know, is it a kind of thing where that ground ball that became a single for you is a ground out 99% of the time? Now we have the shifts which take care of some of that stuff. There's all these different variables, and you look at ERA versus FIP. None of that stuff was really around, or it certainly wasn't accepted in 2011 like it is now. Do you think in hindsight, just from an approach standpoint, like a mentality thing, if you had had some of those numbers at your fingertips, it would have been a little bit more peace of mind to just, hey, keep being you, don't overhaul this?
Oh, for sure. I think now that I understand it more, you know, I think when any pitcher is going through a rough patch, what you want to hear is, you know, you look great. Like everything looks fine. Just keep doing what you're doing. But you got to actually believe that as the guy out there performing in order to get through it. I think that's what the best in the world, guys who have 10-year, you know, MLB careers, that's what they do. They're able to take those rough patches and say, put my head down. I don't care about my stats. I know who I am. Give me 500 at bats. Give me, you know, a full season's worth of outings and, you know, my numbers will be there. And, you know, I think I'm kind of, I think more analytically minded than maybe some guys. And if you just say, hey, you look good, keep doing it. Like in my head, I'm like, it doesn't feel right. Something's not right. So I think to have like some numbers, like you said, some of those kind of new age stats to back that up, like, no, you actually are throwing the ball the same, or you know, you're actually having statistically like really bad luck, like I'd be like, okay, I'm just gonna stick with the plan and keep doing what I'm doing.
I mean, I can't even overstate enough the amount of, I feel like it's the overwhelming majority of our work with, you know, veteran big leaguers. When we're talking about guys that, you know, 3-4 years or more in the big leagues, I feel like so much of, you know, particularly what our pitching guys at the facility are doing is we're re-engineering the best version of themselves, where they say, hey, I felt unreal in August of 2019. We got to go back and look at videos of that. And that you can do that now. You know, that everybody has high-speed camera footage of themselves. Everybody has all of their metrics. They, chances are they have, you know, an iPad that was issued to them by the team that they can go back and pull up I remember Blake Treinen saying, you know, hey, this was the best pitch I have ever thrown, and it was accessible online in 10 seconds, you know, years ago. It was a front hit, 101 mile an hour, two seamers. It's like, all right, we know what you did then. Let's go back and just reverse engineering that. Like, do you find yourself going back and doing that? Like, can you do that here in 2020 to see what was going well in 2010, 2011, when you were at your best? Or is it just so far removed that you're really comparing yourself to the, you know, the mid 30s Daniel Barr that you are now?
Oh, honestly, I spent a lot of time from like 12 to 17 watching a lot of old video and trying to do exactly what you just said. We didn't have as advanced approach as what we're able to do today, you know, even 5, 6, 7 years ago. But I actually found, especially the video, I found myself like, I would watch video of myself dominating and I go try to, you know, reenact that that day on a mound. And I found myself like trying to move my body the same way as I used to or whatever. And all these internal cues would pop up like, oh, this is where my leg was. This is where my arm was. And there's one thing I've learned, something that makes the yips way worse is internal cueing. And so
not surprising, right? But interesting.
I didn't know that at the time. Pitching coaches, especially kind of old school guys, use a lot of internal cues, and you watch video on yourself and you start saying, oh, this is where my arm slot was. Let me reenact this arm slot. And to me, I think that's the best way to, you know, make the yips a whole lot worse, if anything. So I found kind of through my journey that I basically started searching for a mindset. Because the best example I have is there's this like the signature, it's called like the signature test. So if I asked you, hey, sign your name right here. Don't think about it. Just sign your name. Boom. You sign it. You sign some cool signature. And I said, okay, copy that signature exactly, you know, line for line, dot for dot. It needs to look exactly the same. You'd go really slow and you'd come out with this thing at the end that probably looks terrible. And like this very unnatural version of your signature.
It's a great analogy. The best
way to recreate it is to just do another fast one, right? Without thinking, let your automaticity take over. So when I kind of learned that concept, I kind of took that to pitching and I'm like, look, I don't have a perfect delivery on these. I don't execute these pitches because I'm telling each body part exactly where to go at the right time. I'm in the right mindset, and this is just what my body does when my mind's in the right space. So that's kind of when I realized, like, this is something that needs to be addressed on the mental side, and start chasing that mindset that led to those pitches, led to my body moving really efficiently and throwing 100 miles an hour. What mindset allowed me to do that, and then see if my body figures it out.
That's really fascinating. And I, you know, as you were talking about it, I was thinking back to like I wrote an article way back in like 2007, 2018. I'm literally pulling it up as you're talking. I think we overemphasize the importance of repeatability, right? Because we've framed this in our mind that, you know, you're the best pitcher on the planet. We see all the, you know, the images of guys tunneling and, you know, overlaying pitches on one another. And, you know, we think it's the same thing over and over again. I think that drives some of our training initiatives. It's this kind of unyielding specificity. And we certainly see guys throwing live probably earlier than ever before. We see more guys throwing all off season. I went back in and I looked at the hardest throwers. The three hardest throwers in MLB in 2017 were Aroldis Chapman, Joe Kelly, and Trevor Rosenthal. And basically looked at the 50 hardest pitches in baseball. And I looked at the variance and extension on those three pitches that year. So this is, you know, we can't even play like the TrackMan to Hawkeye. This is comparing apples and apples. You know, Chapman's extension range from 6.5 to 7.2. Kelly's range from 5.7 to 6.5. Rosenthal's range from 5.5 to 5.9. And if you actually look at the velocity ranges on these guys, Chapman 95.4 to 102.1, Kelly 96 to 102, Rosenthal 95.5 to 101.7. So in a given year, the three hardest throwing people on the planet had dramatic standard deviations, both in terms of how they delivered the baseball, how hard the baseball came out, presumably where it went relative to their intentions. And I just think we get so caught up in trying to reproduce mechanics kind of to your internal focus point that, that maybe it's the solution isn't unyielding specificity. Maybe it's preparing athletes both physically and mentally to have some adjustability in the challenges that face them in competition.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what you just described is like, that's what great athletes do is like your foot can land in a slightly different place or you can be a little faster through your delivery and like you, your body instinctually just makes up for it. And you come up with like, not the exact same, but like a very similar release point to where, yeah, I can throw 98 to 100 in the same general area very, very reliably. No, it's not the same every time. But yeah, I think that's what really good athletes do on the mound.
I'm curious, you mentioned, you know, kind of in that 2013 to 2017 timeline, you tried a lot of things with a lot of different organizations. Obviously, internal focus cues was something that, that didn't help you. Were there other things that you know, were equally, you know, unsuccessful? And then, you know, obviously beyond external focus cues, were there any things that you found really clicked during that time and ultimately helped you to come back?
Yeah, I learned a lot. I tried everything, at least everything I could think of, you know, within reason, but talked with a lot of different, you know, sports psych type people. And some of those talks and relationships are really good. And others, you know, I could have gone without, I think. So, and that's kind of why I wanted to get into the mental skills department arena when I did retire in 17 was because I was like, I've seen, you know, six different organizations and how they treat the mental side of the game and seen some things done well and I've seen some things done not so well, you know, and I just want to try to help some players with the stuff I've learned, even though it didn't get me all the way back, you know, at that time.
It is an interesting like perspective. I feel like some guys have very, you know, I don't want to say negative experiences, but they have never negative perceptions on working with mental skills coaches. And you deal with other people who, you know, rave about their experiences. And, you know, like I've even talked to free agents who critically, you know, analyze that before they'll sign with a team. Like, were there certain things that jumped out to you about the mental skills folks that you worked with, whether it was with teams or in the private sector that, you know, helped you more than others?
I mean, I realized that ultimately it starts with a relationship. Mm-hmm. People, you know, it's good. The same for strength and conditioning. You know, I'm sure you felt it. Like, you can't get full buy-in until you have a person's trust. Mm-hmm. And you know that as the athlete needs to know that that coach, whether it's a physical or a mental coach, cares about them. You know, as either it's as a person or they care about your career. And so, I mean, that's where it's, I don't care, you know, how much you know until you show how much you care. Mm-hmm. I kind of took that to heart and realized that, like, so when I was coaching, it was about relationships first, you know, and if a guy came to me with a very specific mental skills question, I'd do my best to help him and find that answer. But that usually didn't happen. It usually was weeks or months or even years of developing a friendship. A relationship where I knew he trusted me. I wasn't a pipeline to the front office. I wasn't going to go share everything we talked about with the other coaches, things like that. And then the conversations became really real once you developed that relationship. So I tried to kind of lead with that.
Interesting. Do you think to some degree, I mean, obviously like a lot of your struggles were at the major league level where you're one of 25 guys on a roster, one of 40 on a 40 man. Do you think part of the challenge in pro baseball is just that there are so many guys that, you know, to some degree players get lost in the shuffle. And when you are struggling with something like this, it's hard to get to that point of no like trust where you can actually get the help you need when struggling with something like this.
Absolutely. I mean, especially when you got 150 guys in a minor league system, you know, and guys struggle for the first time and they literally, you know, see their teammates like passing them. Mm-hmm. You know, you see a guy who you were ahead of on, you know, you were a level above the year before, he just took your promotion to double A or whatever. You can see when you're like stalling and getting passed, and it's not a very good feeling because I've been there. And I try to be aware of that when I was working with guys and, you know, just realize the the stress that comes with being a minor league baseball player, especially guys, I think, who sign out of high school who have never really struggled before. It's a really, really, really tough thing. And it's way more common to struggle with the mental side of it than people realize.
The other question I have, and I'm curious as to whether you've been asked this over the years, is obviously you were not playing in the most forgiving media market during your time, you know, in the big leagues back early in your career. Do you think that, you know, exacerbated things more than it would have been if you had been in a smaller market? So I know that obviously there's no opportunity to turn it off, you know, in that world. Did you look back and see if that impacted you?
Oh, for sure. I think, you know, people ask, like, yeah, what was it like playing Boston? I say, well, if the team's playing well and you're playing well, it's the best place on the planet to play baseball. If things aren't going well, it's the worst place on the planet to play baseball. And I probably didn't handle it as well as, you know, certain guys did, but it's not easy. And I think that was one thing I think that I got caught up in was the just giving the game, giving baseball too much importance in my life and too much meaning. You know, when you start getting paid a lot of money and you put a big stadium around you full of fans and people are writing things about you every day and your performance, like, it starts to mean a lot to you. It's kind of hard not to. So it took me a long time. Still probably something I'm learning on a daily basis, but I think that's what allowed me to get back to playing was really just changing my perspective about the game and getting back to viewing it as, you know, a game that we get to play and how just being grateful for the opportunity rather than like that feeling of like, I have to make this work. This is life or death. I need to, you know, keep everybody happy and keep this job and keep making money and all those things that come along with it.
Interesting. So as you alluded to, in 2018, you signed on with the Diamondbacks to become a franchise player mentor, and you discussed, you know, kind of what that role entailed and how it developed in the years that followed. Kind of the thing I'm actually really intrigued about is it seems like, and you had a profound impact on a lot of players. I know we had a number of prospects for the Diamondbacks that spoke, you know, glowingly about their experience with you. But what I think is also intriguing is that it sounds like that experience also made you a better coach of yourself. And they say, you know, the hardest person to coach is yourself. And that's one reason why it's so challenging to self-correct when you're out on a mound and they're, you know, 40,000 screaming fans watching you and your coach is, you know, 30 yards away in the dugout. But it does seem like coaching made you a better coach of yourself. You know, were there key takeaways from working with younger players that helped you, like that you in those conversations with them were like, wow, this was something that I could have really utilized years ago?
Oh, for sure. You pretty much hit the nail on the head. I didn't intend for it to be that. I took that job with the D-backs, you know, fully ready to start a whole new career path for myself and really tried not to look back on my playing career unless it was something that would help me in what I was doing. But I kind of accidentally stumbled into some things and started feeling different. You know, I think the biggest thing that I saw that you're able to see once you step away as a player is how emotional you make so many decisions based on emotion and you go out and try to perform sometimes with a lot of emotion buried up inside and it's going to affect you. Like you can pretend it's not, but it's going to affect you. So I think being able to step outside myself for a minute and kind of, I saw a lot of my younger self, you know, in those players that I was working with. And, you know, I got really honest about, you know, some shortcomings or just personality traits that I had that maybe weren't super beneficial to being a great a great athlete, great performer. And okay, this is a weakness, this is a mental, you know, whatever it is, it's a mental shortcoming, weakness. This is something I can work on. Once you realize that those mental shortcomings can be addressed just like a physical shortcoming, just like having, you know, weak hamstrings or whatever, weak shoulder, like you can address that and spend some time and get it right. And once I realized that those things could actually be improved upon, it took like, you know, growth mindset toward the mental side. It's not just this set of characteristics that I'm born with that I gotta, you know, this is it. This is what I gotta live with. Like you can change some of those things. You can adapt. It really just kind of opened my eyes to a whole new way of seeing the game.
We have in strength addition, we have effectively foundational principles, right? You have to do this in order to earn the right to do this, in order to set yourself up to do this later in a career. Like you're not going to give guys, you know, a crazy aggressive throwing program and, you know, all these elaborate strength conditioning approaches if they can't do a bodyweight lunge. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned, you know, experiencing all these different organizations, the good and the bad. And also, you know, you're now in a clubhouse where, like, you know, you're teammates with, you know, AJ Ramos, who's got a ton of time in the big leagues, has been through Tommy John and a shoulder surgery. So you've dealt with, you know, experienced guys on that realm. And then, you know, in your job with the Diamondbacks, you were working with, you know, 17, 18, 19 year old kids who really didn't know what the world had in store for them. Are there foundational principles in your eyes from like a mental preparation standpoint? Like, where do you begin when you have that conversation with either A, the kid that was just drafted, or, you know, B, the young phenom who gets called up to the big leagues at age 20 and has no idea what's ahead for himself. Do you see certain things that you have to, you know, teach to them to make them successful in that vein?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's just like what you do. You introduce them to kind of the basic concepts in that realm, in that mental skills realm. And a lot of it is about trying a lot of different things, seeing what you like, seeing what you don't like, seeing what makes you uncomfortable. Like maybe sometimes that's a good thing if you're uncomfortable, and trying those things out. And then you get to know through that whole process, you're getting to know a lot about yourself. And I think it's the same thing. You progress, you kind of choose your path, as they say. And, you know, it's funny thing you mentioned AJ, we had some conversations at the end of last year. Like, he's had every, you know, physical issue you can name to keep him out of the game. He's battled his way back. And we had like very similar mindset, even though we had like two very different types of struggles. We kind of have arrived at like a similar place, I think. Tyler Matzik was another guy who had a pretty awesome comeback story last year. Very similar to what I went through. And I got to work with him with the D-backs. A couple years ago, we stayed in touch a little bit, and like, again, very similar. We've kind of gotten to a similar place where you just kind of accept your weaknesses, work on them, and get to a point where, you know, you're grateful to be there, grateful for every opportunity you get, and just allow yourself to completely get lost in the moment every time you get a baseball in your hand. So I think that's, we've all had to get to that point kind of through different means.
I like it. And this is going to change gears a little bit. You know, it goes without saying that the mental and the mechanical components of your comeback have been discussed heavily. I'm actually just as curious about the physical aspect of things. So you went 7 years without pitching in the big leagues and then came back throwing just as hard. And that was actually without fans in the stands too. So equally, you know, even more so impressive. You know, would you consider it a young arm, you know, or were there adjustments that you've had to manage arm stress as you've aged? I know obviously you were still throwing for a big chunk of time in the middle there, but were there things that you've had to recalibrate compared to, you know, what you're doing back in, you know, almost a decade ago?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at from 2014 until I retired in 2017, I think on paper, I only threw like 15 innings, maybe 20. I don't know. It wasn't many.
Yeah.
Because a lot of that was because I'd go out and, you know, I'd get two outings a week at wherever I was at doing some kind of rehab assignment, and I'd get like one out in two outings, you know. So, like, I wasn't adding up innings, but I mean, damn it if I wasn't throwing as much or more than anybody else, because on the side and in between outings, like, I threw a ton, probably sometimes way too much. So I was definitely throwing. As far as keeping my body in shape, the mental side for me was such a struggle for a long time and such a mess that I really, I spent a ton of time in the weight room, in the training room, because I was like, look, I can't control the mental side, but I feel like I can control the physical side. I can get really strong. You know, I didn't have a lot of confidence coming from what my performance on the field was doing. So I threw all that energy into the weight room and try to get as strong as I possibly could, because that made me feel good. Again, sometimes probably took it too far. Got hurt a few times doing some things I probably shouldn't have been doing, but luckily it wasn't anything serious. But I do think that throwing myself into the strength side that way is why I'm able to, you know, still throw the way I do now. Even after the 2 years I was, you know, retired, I was doing some beach workouts and stuff. Nice. But it wasn't anything, you know, like I would have done if I was playing. So I kind of did a crash course last off season when I was considering playing again. Mm-hmm. I did like 3 or 4 months where I was just really getting after it, 'cause I was like, look, if I do end up deciding to do this, I can't have my body fall apart a month in. Yeah. And I mean, I was pretty weak. I was down to like 195 pounds, which is probably like 15 pounds under my playing weight. Mm-hmm. So I needed to get that strength back. And I really didn't get it back fully until I think now. I'm gotten back up to the weight that I want to be. Last year I felt good. I felt really loose. Never had any days where I didn't feel like I could pitch. But then again, it was a 60-game season, which was like, that worked out perfect for me because
to your credit, you did it at altitude too. So
yeah, that's a factor too, for sure. But yeah, I think if I had to throw 60, 70 games like last year, my first year back, I'd have been in trouble. Getting the 25 or whatever I got was like a perfect kind of ease me back in for a year. So it should be good to go for this year.
What was the when was the moment that you knew that you wanted to make the comeback? You know, after walking away in 17, like, was there a day when you were just playing catch and it clicked, or how did you actually make that decision?
Yeah. So kind of throughout that second year of coaching, I was playing a lot of catch with players just as part of my job and just as a way to connect with guys. And I started having play. I noticed myself, I'm like, oh, I can throw again without like overthinking it. And it's going where I want it to go. This is kind of fun again. This is weird that it feels this good. It's probably just 'cause I don't care. You know, I'm out here not focused on making myself better. I'm just trying to make, you know, these players better.
And serving others is a huge part of coaching.
Kind
of
takes your mind off stuff. Completely off myself. And I think that freed me up to just throw the way that I was meant to throw. And throughout the year, I noticed it kept getting better and better. And I started having players being like, dude, well, you're throwing harder than me. Why don't you pitch again? I'm like, and my response is always like, dude, you have no idea what I went through. Like I had days where I felt good playing catch 5 years ago. And the second I stepped on a mound, it was all gone. And so I kind of kept saying that to him and making excuses. But in my own mind, I'm like, I don't think I've ever felt this good for like this long of a period. So it was kind of creeping in that second year. And then I took it into that off season, decided I'm going to get my arm into good enough shape to get off a mound just to see what's in there. So I threw into a net in my backyard for like 2 months. Just threw a bucket of balls in every couple days, got my arm in good enough shape and got on a mound like December, January, about a year ago. And cut a few loose. Luke was there. Luke was with me. It was just me and him, like an indoor facility, and it went pretty well. I did it again a week later, went really well. I was throwing mid-90s strikes, and I was like, this is really fun. Like, I haven't had this much fun with a baseball in my hand in a long time. So I think I threw like 3 or 4 bullpens. They were all good. I felt free, easy. I was like, this is it. This is how it's supposed to feel. And I made every excuse to not do it, to not come back. Like, I was like, this is crazy. I have 3 kids, got a steady job that I enjoy. Like, I'm 35 years old. This is stupid. And then I'd be like, but it feels so good. Like, what if this is it? And so I had a lot of conversations with my wife, and, you know, she basically talked me into doing it. She was like, she's like, I can tell if you don't do this, you're going to regret it the rest of your life. And when that feeling kind of settled in and became real, I'm like, you know what? Life's short. I gotta, you know, the way I viewed it too, I think having 3 kids, my oldest is 5. Like, I was like, he doesn't understand what's going on right now, but when he's 15, 20, whatever, later in life, and I can tell this story to him, like, I did something because I believed in it. And I chased a dream when there was not a whole lot of prospects for it to go well, but I truly believed in it. So I went after it. And, you know, I was okay with failing in that situation because of the lesson it would provide for my kids. And luckily that's not what happened.
Nice, man. So one thing that I think is interesting, and maybe this follows up on what we talked about earlier, is you're still throwing both a two seam and a four seam plus a changeup. But you switched to a slider instead of a curveball. Is that correct?
I threw the slider. It was more of a slower slurve back in Boston. And for whatever reason, I didn't change the grip or anything. But last year it was coming out a lot harder, like 4 or 5 miles an hour harder. And I was actually trying to slow it down.
Interesting.
Year. So it's kind of a work in progress.
It's an adjustment. It worked.
I actually like the slower, the 84, 85 one better. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think the message is most people, when they struggle, right, they look to narrow the focus, right? So they drop their worst pitch, they do anything like that. Like, you actually, you know, kept yours exactly the same. And, you know, depending on how you look at the slider, you know, maybe even add it to the repertoire and are learning how to manipulate it differently. Was there ever a thought of, I mean, honestly, this was like a conversation with Kurt Schilling back in like 2009. He was always very adamant, and granted, he was a true four seam guy. Like, you're better off throwing 1,000 of one than you are throwing 500 of each. Did you ever look to narrow the focus and drop the change up or anything like that? Or was that never a, you know, even a consideration in all this?
No, I mean, I try, you know, in my journey trying to fix things the first time, you know, I was throwing submarine by the time I finally retired with the Mets. I had dropped to sidearm. I had dropped completely to submarine with the Mets, which was, shoot, I mean, if you could see video of that, you'd laugh. It was, I tried everything, and it really was never about pitch mix, because ultimately I knew if I couldn't throw my fastball for a strike, it was going to be hard to pitch in the big leagues. So no, I knew that. I kind of go back, when my mind's right, I can throw 8 pitches. Like, I can drop curveballs in, I can throw sinkers, I can throw 2 different changeups. Like, when my mind's right, there's freedom. Mm-hmm. And like, that's why, like, last year, I kind of like forced myself to get as free as I possibly could on the mound. I would like change the shape of my breaking ball in the middle of the outing, just like to see what happened. I would change my delivery. Like, I do pauses at the top, slide steps with nobody on, you know, never come set, just weird things to like mess with the hitter's timing. Mm-hmm. And I never, ever could have done that. Even when I was at my best in Boston, I still was more like, I had to be a robot. Like, I had to do the same tempo every pitch to feel right. And so I knew something was different last year. And I think it just came with maturity and different mindset and allowing myself to have that freedom. Like, no, you don't have to move your body perfectly every pitch to get it out.
There's a lot of really, really good lessons that I'm going to go back and listen to it again. All right. So we always do a lightning round on the tail end of these interviews. And normally it's like the, you know, what pitchers do you like to watch? Who's your favorite teammate? All that stuff. I think with yours, we can actually be way more targeted. So I'm sure you've read a ton of books as you work through this process as both a player and a coach. Any particular books that you would recommend to coaches, players, parents, et cetera?
It's an author. Rise of Superman by Stephen Kotler. It's a book about flow states. It describes it really well. And he's written a couple follow-up books. Stealing Fire was one of them, I think. I think they're really good as far as just really doing a good job of describing the mindset when things are going really well in any performance, not just baseball, but could be music, could be standing up, giving a speech, like whatever. You can achieve that flow state in a lot of different ways, but he's probably the best I have found describing it.
Nice. What about lessons to a player who is going through the yips? Like, you know, and obviously there's varying degrees of it. There's the one bad outing, and then there's the 20 bad outings in a row. What do you tell a young player who's dealing with these struggles? You know, it's probably not in the magnitude that you dealt with them, but, you know, where do they start?
Yeah. So first of all, there's no magic pill. There's not something you can do one time or do this for 3 days and you're going to feel great. I always thought since the yips came on so fast, I could get out of it fast too. And that's, I just don't think that's the case. With some people, I think it is. I've heard guys say, yeah, I had the yips for like a week or a month and it's gone, like whatever. I'm like, great. You know, I think everybody's different. But I think there's like my case lasted 7 years, basically 6 years. I mean, I think I even probably had a version of it early in my career in the minor leagues. I know I did. So for me, it's about taking a long-term approach, realizing that the fact that you have the yips, there's some deep-seated, there's nothing wrong with you. First of all, there's nothing wrong with you. I should have led off with that. There's nothing wrong with you. There's some things that certain people have in their personality, just the way their mind's wired, that make them a little more predisposed to becoming internally focused or worrying about what other people are thinking of them. People get overly self-aware. I have all those characteristics and I had to learn a way around them because I knew none of them helped me perform better. So it's about getting to know yourself, you know, be realistic, be honest with yourself. If you have some of those personality traits or whatever you want to call them, just be honest, have coaches, friends, teammates that are honest with you. And I think it's something that can be worked through. I hope that my story is proof of that.
And then, you know, you even hinted at like changes in coaching staff and, you know, there are obviously going to be coaches and parents listen to this as well. What can those people and, you know, in mentorship roles and different capacities do to help when, you know, they're seeing a 17-year-old that's struggling in this vein? What would have helped you, I guess, looking back on it?
Yeah. I mean, I think you got to realize that that player going through that is having amazing internal battle. Like it's embarrassing. There's anxiety that comes with it. It doesn't just affect you when you're out on the mound or on the field. It affects you 24/7. Like when it was at the worst for me, I would fall asleep thinking about my throwing mechanics and I would wake up and my first thought would be, okay, how am I going to throw today? Literally, like it takes over your mind. It can. And you got to realize like, that's not fun to go through. It's given me a whole new awareness for just all different types of mental health issues. Just because you don't understand why someone can't throw a baseball or you don't understand why this person's mental process isn't working for them. Don't just rub it off. It's like, oh, just don't think, just throw. Like that's the worst thing I ever got. And I knew it came from really well-meaning people.
Yeah.
Like they wanted to help. They're like, hey, no one cares. Just throw it. Like, don't think, just throw. Like, obviously that's the goal. That's what we're trying to get back to. It's more complicated than that. That is the end goal. But when you're going through it, that's the hardest thing in the world is to don't think, just throw. So, there are tools, you know, meditation, mindfulness that were huge tools for me, but they took kind of months or years to really have an effect. So, but allowed me to get back to being in the moment, trusting my body, enjoying the moment, all those things that you have to get back to.
This was absolutely awesome. This is one of my favorite podcasts that we've done. This is, you know, 90 episodes in. So, and you're in some really good company. So, I'm super impressed and I actually learned a lot too, that I hope will help me to help some athletes here moving forward. So, thanks so much for taking the time. Glad we were able to pass the time on our hotel quarantine day as we start up this major league season together.
Absolutely, man. Couldn't think of a better way.
Right on, man. And best of luck this year. I won't wish you luck cause I know you're prepared. Luck's for people who don't prepare. So, go get them this year. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate it, man. Have a great year.
You too.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd be thrilled if you'd consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving us a review to read on iTunes. We welcome your suggestions for future guests and questions. Just email elitebaseballpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for your continued support. And we'll see you next episode.